after World War II, DDT came home a hero. That is a line from medical historian Elena Konis' new book that traces the legacy of this powerfully toxic pesticide. It's our focus this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. DDT was the go-to solution for a laundry list of problems to kill insects that destroyed crops and carried disease. But scientists and corporations, the federal government, they couldn't see eye to eye on DDT and its risk to the planet. Join in on DDT from your Wisconsin angle. Like, what do you remember from the DNR hearings in the late 60s? 800-642-1234. Elena Konis is a professor of history and journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. Her new book is called How to Sell a Poison, The Rise, Fall, and Toxic Return of DDT. Elena, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start a little more contemporary on attacks against science, and then we'll move back in time into history. But science has become so polarized, we see, with bitter disagreements over the pandemic, with climate change. What parallels do you see with the fight over DDT to today's scientific debates?
Sure. Well, this is such a good question because, of course, I'm a historian. I write about the past, and I've just written an entire book about a chemical that we banned, you know, 50 years ago this year. So why look backwards? That's a really good question. We, as you pointed out, are living in a moment in which science is so hotly contested. You know, people in my neighborhood where I live in Berkeley will put signs out on their lawn saying that they believe in science. And, you know, part of this has been driven by the COVID pandemic, but this kind of idea that there are people who believe in science and people who don't feels like it's been present with us for the last several years. We've been fighting about vaccines and climate change, GMOs, you know, the risks of cell phones, you name it. And to me, as a historian who studies the history of science in particular, I was really interested in looking at something, a scientific topic that had been controversial in the past. And DDT came to mind for a couple of reasons. One reason is that it's an example of something where we were so sure of ourselves about it. When we developed DDT during the Second World War, and we used it after the war was over. Everybody was using it, supposedly without question. And then 25 years later, in the early 50s, we banned it. As you guys noted in the setup at the top of the hour, in the 2000s, there were people saying we needed to bring it back. So another 25 years later, people were saying, wait, let's reevaluate this again. So here was this chemical, this scientific technology on which we had changed our mind back and forth and back and forth. And then there was something else that struck me about it. I'm a historian of science, and part of what I study is the history of vaccines. And as we know, vaccines have been so controversial recently.
Yes.
But the history of vaccination shows that actually vaccination has been controversial as long as we've been practicing it. And as I was looking into the history of vaccination in this country about 10, 15 years ago, one thing that kept coming up that I was really curious about was that folks who had doubts about vaccination kept pointing to DDT as the case example, proving that scientists and experts and government officials who rely on science, quote, can't be trusted because they make mistakes and they get things wrong. And we might not know until further down the line. So, yeah, so DDT was a way of kind of looking at this pattern in the past and seeing how it worked in the past, how it is that people kind of made up their mind to either trust the science or not trust the science.
What you say there really causes me pause to explore that thread you have about junk science because of today and that careful, you know, orchestration to fight government regulation and to create suspicion around, you know, scientific studies and special interest groups working to those means. How did junk science, you know, that approach intersect with DDT?
Such a good question. Yeah. And to answer that, I'm going to back up a couple of decades before we even started using the term junk science. Because again, as we noted, DDT, this insect killer that was supposedly not toxic to humans, was so warmly welcomed during the war and in the post-war era. But there were scientists at the time who were saying, hold on a second, this is a chemical that we can see kills all bugs, not just the ones we want to control. It kills beneficial insects, birds, bees, birds as well as bees and butterflies, small amphibians, reptiles, small fish. And there were scientists who noted that it was collecting in body fat. So from the very beginning, in this moment of enthusiasm, there were folks saying, hold on, let's proceed with caution. And their numbers started to grow from the late 40s into the early 50s, to the point where in the 1950s, DDT was one target of congressional hearings looking at the safety of chemicals in the food supply. And at this moment, the chemical industry started holding these monthly meetings, started hiring Madison Avenue PR firms to shape the public's opinion on chemicals. And they came up with a handful of messages. And one of them was, chemicals are safe. You know, grandma uses chemicals in her home canning. You don't have to be afraid of them. There's nothing different about natural versus synthetic chemicals. And they kept this campaign up for decades. And their point was, don't believe the science that you're hearing that's critical of chemicals. They weren't yet using the phrase junk science, but they were developing the tools that industries, the chemical industry, the fossil fuel industry, the tobacco industry, would then continue to use, develop, hone, and expand on for the next several decades. And yeah, go ahead, because I haven't even come back to the word junk science yet.
I was just going to reintroduce you here. Elena Conis, author of How to Sell a Poison, the Rise, Fall, and Toxic Return of DDT. As we look at its legacy, where it's at today, you can join in on what you remember about DDT, especially here in Wisconsin, 800-642-1234. You know, Elena, one thing... When we're going back in time, you describe this Swiss chemist who ate a chunk of DDT in front of the U.S. Surgeon General and was like, look, if I'm alive tomorrow, you know, all is well with DDT. And it was really horrifying. So what were those early days of DDT exploration like?
So one thing that we've become accustomed to thinking about with respect to pesticides and other toxic chemicals is you don't eat them, right? Like today, even if we're told something is safe, we don't eat it unless, of course, it's in our food supply and it's there as a preservative or an additive. But one of the things that was so interesting to me about the early history of DDT was why it was so easy to convince people that it was safe when so many scientists were saying, hold on, it's toxic. It is a poison. And the reason had to do with the chemicals that were being used in agriculture in particular before DDT. You know, we had been using insect killers. They were called insecticides. Pesticide didn't actually become a widely used term until the mid-20th century. But we were using these insect killers in the late 19th century. And the most effective ones were based on lead and arsenic, these and copper and other compounds that today we're like, oh, right, that's poisonous, right? You wouldn't eat arsenic. But we sprayed it on apples, we sprayed it on grapes. And the whole idea was you get the produce to market, you make sure it's clean, and then you sell it. But there were cases of poisonings throughout the 1900s, 1910s, 1920s. So there was this ongoing search for a safer insect killer. And the thing that made DDT seem so innocuous was that you could spray it on your apples. You could eat those apples without rinsing them, and you wouldn't be immediately poisoned. So yeah, the Swiss chemist was like, I'm going to prove that this is the holy grail of insect killers. And he was living in New Jersey working for a firm called Geigy, which had its headquarters in Basel, Switzerland, but offices here. And he hopped on the train. He went down to DC and met with the Surgeon General and said, yeah, look, I'm going to prove to you that this is safe. And he unwrapped a chunk of it, ate it. And the next morning, the Surgeon General said, all right, you've got a big order coming from us. Get ready. We're going to have the Army put this to the test and start using it.
UC Berkeley medicine and public health historian Elena Conis helping us understand this complex history of one of the world's most infamous chemicals, DDT. Join in on Wisconsin's role in DDT's legacy. Maybe you were involved with the Citizens Natural Resources Association in the 50s and 60s, as Elena called a well-organized small army in Wisconsin that worked to ban DDT. Join in, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're learning about the battle over the toxic pesticide DDT over the decades here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Medical historian Elena Conis's new book is called How to Sell a Poison. She writes about how in 1945, Rockford, Illinois wasn't just going to be sprayed with DDT from the ground, but also from B-25 Army bombers taking off from Truax Field. So here's a black and white universal newsreel of that moment.
Today's target for this B-25 is Rockford, Illinois, a peacetime mission to spread 500 gallons of DDT, the Army's miracle insecticide, over the city, stricken with an infantile paralysis epidemic.
Footage courtesy of Critical Past. Join in on DDT 800-642-1234. UC Berkeley Professor Elena Conis with us for the hour. Elena, you can hear that footage from Rockford. Explain what happened in Rockford, Illinois as a test case in the 40s.
Yes, this is such an interesting moment to look back on, especially from the moment that we're living in now, in the midst of our own pandemic and our own struggles with COVID. Back in the 1940s, you know, we were not just fighting World War II abroad, we were fighting an infectious disease of epidemic proportions here at home, polio. And polio had been around for decades, but in the 40s, the epidemics were just getting worse and worse, and nobody knew exactly how it spread or exactly how to stop it. But one theory held that flies were to blame. And this was a disease that was, it took a really hard toll on children. In the worst cases, these children ended up paralyzed in some cases from the neck down, and they were treated in iron lungs that essentially kept them alive by breathing for them. Nobody wanted this for their children. So as the fly theory started to kind of gain traction among scientists, there were some who said, well, wait a second, why don't we just kill all the flies? And you can kind of put the pieces together next. What happened was we had this new insect killer. It was being used in the war to kill insects that were affecting troops, bed bugs and flies and cockroaches in their mess halls, but and barracks, but also mosquitoes in places where they were fighting on the ground. So in the war, we had been spraying it from planes over entire islands in the Pacific. And then news reports back home were telling the American public, our troops are being protected from diseases spread by bugs like malaria, yellow fever, plague, you name it. And that made people back home think, why don't we apply it to kill flies? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Rockford became the site of this important experiment where the nation's polio philanthropy, the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, collaborated with the U.S. Army, got one of those Army bombers, filled it with DDT, and they kept their eyes open for an American city in which a polio epidemic seemed to be starting in the summer of 1945. And they found it in Rockford. And they said, all right, we're going to bring in the best polio scientists in the country. This was a team at Yale. We're going to bring them to Rockford. We're going to spray half the city by plane, and the other half we're not going to spray. And we're going to see how the polio rates look in each half of the city. Well, you can kind of imagine what happened next, because nobody wanted to think that there was a potential polio cure that they weren't going to have access to. So people were freaking out that they weren't going to be sprayed. They wanted to be sprayed. They wanted to protect themselves, their families, their children. And so there was an uproar. And eventually the foundation and the team of scientists had to relent and spray the entire city. It turned out it didn't work. The spray didn't reach the ground very effectively. They had to send out a team of, it was men at the time, on foot to spray the entire city by hand. They also started counting polio cases. And as soon as they started to count, they realized the epidemic was already waning. But once that bomber took off, and once the news cameras and photographers and the journalists just started putting out their accounts of DDT, this miracle chemical doing its peacetime duty, the horse was out of the barn. People across the country were convinced this is how we're going to beat polio. And so we started spraying it for that reason.
I'm going to just reintroduce you, Elena Conis, author of How to Sell a Poison, as we look at the rise, fall, and toxic return of DDT. You can join in what you remember, 800-642-1234. Elena, sometimes I wanted to rename your book The Women of DDT because you told stories of women who were so persistent in trying to tell government health leaders, look, this is toxic. And, you know, it just really opened up a whole world to me beyond Rachel Carson. And one of those people was Daffy Colson down in Georgia, was really relentless in trying to show the toxic effect of the spraying that was going over her little farm. And I'm wondering, you know, what her role was, if you could sketch out Colson and what county health people were telling her and not taking her seriously.
Yeah, Daffy Colson's story was one that I stumbled upon. And as soon as I found this file of letters between her and, oh my gosh, every health official in the state, the country, she was writing to members of Congress and senators from other states, I stumbled across this folder in a Georgia archive. And I said, wow, this is really one of the reasons why history can really help us understand the present in some ways. Mm. You know, one of the things that's an issue when we talk about scientific controversies is who trusts the science that we produce and why do they trust it? And Daffy Colson, going back to the 1940s, is one of these people who had no reason not to trust the science. She had read the news reports about DDT. She knew how helpful it was during the war, but she was a small farmer. She owned a small farm, she and her husband, in southeastern Georgia. And she also read in some farm journals that there were some criticisms of DDT. And in the 1940s, she also started to notice that there were more and more landowners around her who were buying up big, big swaths of land, living remotely, and just having it farmed by employees and having it sprayed by crop dusters and, you know, pilots who would fly these planes and spray their fields from above. This was a very different type of farming than she practiced. Mm. So she was noticing these differences in farming practice, and then she started to feel sick. And she started to come down with a set of symptoms that would affect her every spring. And before long, her sister, who owned a farm just up the road, was suffering the same symptoms, then her daughters and other people in their part of Georgia. And, you know, one piece at a time, they put it together and they said, look, this all coincides with when we're being sprayed by plane with all these chemicals. We know that they're supposedly safe, but this is not how you spray chemicals. Like, you know, small farmers like us, we spray them by hands. We know they're poisonous. We use them in small amounts and we wash them off before we eat anything. We don't let them get in our milk or, you know, we don't let them contaminate our hen house. So they started writing to officials across the state, and the officials would respond to them saying, no, it's safe. It's absolutely safe. The government says it's safe. Scientists say it's safe. And then to themselves, the officials would say, actually, we don't have a lot of information about these chemicals. Let's look into them. Mm. So, you know, late 1940s, Daffy Colson is being told one thing by the health officials and other officials in her state, and they're saying another thing to each other. So she stays on this, and she really tries to start a movement to stop the use of DDT in particular, just happens to be the chemical that she knows the most about, that's getting the most coverage, right? And she's not successful. And to make a very long story short, you know, after years of struggle to get the truth, and years in which she ends up finding out about DDT's toxicity from the manufacturers themselves, who happily answer her and say, yeah, it's toxic, be careful with it. You know, after years of struggle, she decides, I've got to get out. It's too hard to farm under these conditions. I don't have my health. My children don't have their health. We're losing our chicks. All of our bees are dying off. And she, you know, sells the farm and moves to the big city. And in the process, you can tell reading her letters, she has completely lost faith in government and scientific expertise. And, you know, she's just one case example, one small story representing a kind of larger struggle to understand where truth lies, who it serves, and then, you know, come to your own conclusion about it.
We're going to take a call and then we're going to go to a break and get an answer here. But Mary Kay in Kenosha, can you field your question?
Yeah, I remember the days up at the Dells where they would fog in the morning and you didn't go up there till they were done fogging. But I noticed this year that a lot of ticks are out there, and we haven't been fogging, okay? And I'd like to know if other countries are already using DDT on their vegetables.
Mary Kay, thank you for that. So going to the Wisconsin Dells, had noticed fogging in the morning, and also want to tie this to other countries, what they see there for spraying. We have UC Berkeley Professor of History and Journalism Alina Konis leading us through our nation's fraught history with DDT. Its destructive legacy, its surprising comeback. Join in how you remember DDT, whether you were part of the grassroots activism that led the way to its banning. 800-642-1234. We'll be back with more conversation. Alina Konis here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing DDT, the incredibly toxic, controversial pesticide, ignited skepticism among scientists, divided America over what level of chemical is safe to put into the environment, put into our bodies. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the 40s, the pesticide exploded in popularity, spraying from air over the likes of Arkansas cotton crops and inside homes. UC Berkeley medical historian Alina Konis, her new book is called How to Sell a Poison, with us for the hour. Alina, we heard from Mary Kay in Kenosha and talking about the release of foggers, these bug foggers in Wisconsin Dells and treating areas with these foggers. Also, you know, how wanting to know how DDT is sprayed in other countries. What would you say there?
Sure. So this is so interesting. And this ties back to the story that we were talking about with respect to polio before the break. When we started spraying DDT to kill flies, what happened was we kind of opened Pandora's box in a way. We started spraying towns that had polio cases. And we also, in the late 1940s, started spraying towns that were just afraid of polio. And before long, before you knew it, we were just spraying left and right. And even as we started to understand that the fly theory didn't hold water, and in the early 50s, we started testing, and then by 1954, 55, we had approved a polio vaccine, the practice of spraying DDT just to make communities comfortable was just so deeply ingrained. So, you know, fairgrounds, parks, playgrounds, schools, by that time they had been spraying for the better part of a decade, and they were going to keep spraying because this was a way to just make life, if not healthy, then more comfortable. But this was exactly the sort of practice that gave people who testified before Congress about DDT's harms in the 50s, and then also Rachel Carson, who we mentioned briefly, pause. And, you know, Carson was one of those who thought from the get-go, wait, we need to be listening to these scientists who are raising important concerns about DDT. And one of the things that she wrote about in Silent Spring was that our use of pesticides had just gone too far, that we were using them in a way that they were never designed to be used. And that meant that we were being exposed to them at levels that we had never studied and never even fathomed. So this is part of the kind of undoing of DDT. She published her book on these questions, Silent Spring, in 1962. And, you know, there was already a push against DDT coming from small farmers like Daffy Colson, coming from farm workers like the United Farm Workers out here in California, and others, entomologists, beekeepers, and the like. And Rachel Carson gave their concerns kind of visibility and credibility, and then it kind of took off from there. So by the late 1960s, towns and communities were turning against DDT, including also some entire states like Wisconsin. And yeah, and so we started in the late 1960s to ban it locally. In the early 1970s, there was a federal ban on it.
And we were not alone. Countries elsewhere were also banning it, except for countries where malaria was still a major public health problem. And this brings me to the other part of Mary Kay's question, which is that those are the countries that are still using it today. It's only still used really in places where malaria is still causing a significant amount of illness and death.
What impact does it have on malaria?
So what DDT does is it kills insects, and it does this in two ways. Insects can either come in contact with it and die, or they can eat it and die. It depends on the insect. And when DDT is sprayed in malarious areas, insects land on the sprayed surfaces. Mosquitoes in particular that transmit malaria land on that surface, and then they go away and they die. And that stops them from biting another person and transmitting the disease that they're carrying in their bodies to the next person. And it's an effective way to do this. It's not the only insecticide that can do this. And there are scientists who are continuing to study how DDT affects people in areas where it's still sprayed for malaria. And this is, you know, one of those examples in which we get a kind of classic kind of cost-benefit calculation that has to be made. You know, yes, DDT can protect your children and everybody else from malaria, but it also may slow your children's development in some way. And we know that now.
I want to pause here, reintroduce you. Elena Conis, professor of history and journalism at UC Berkeley, where she focuses on the history of medicine and environmental health as we look at the legacy of DDT. You can join in 800-642-1234. Brad is with us from Madison. Hi, Brad. Go ahead.
Among my biggest concerns with DDT is the disruption of our hormones and our development. DDT does this along with lead and forever chemicals like PFAS, and they, I think, are causing widespread harm. There's possible correlation with ADD, autism, cancers, immune system. Like the vaccines don't work as well when these chemicals are present. And I guess another concern of mine is our military is not regulated properly. At military bases across the country and the world, they have these harmful chemicals, and they're not being stopped from using them or cleaning them up.
Brad, I want to just pause right here. And Elena, I want you to unpack what Brad is saying, especially on the impact of DDT on human development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this took us a long time to figure out, and Brad's point is such a good one. DDT is what we now call an endocrine disruptor. It mimics hormones, and by mimicking hormones or acting like a hormone in the body, it affects how our own hormones can do their work. Sometimes it amplifies their effects, sometimes it dampens their effects. And we were really slow to put the pieces together on this. You know, there were studies, again, going back to the 1940s, in which scientists fed DDT to chickens, and they noticed, oh, well, the male chickens who are eating DDT have smaller combs and smaller testicles. What's going on here? Nobody really knew how to interpret it, but decades later, a team of scientists looking at an array of different chemicals all came together and had what's a now famous meeting that also took place in Wisconsin. And they realized that a number of these chemicals with staying power, Brad called them forever chemicals in particular, had the ability to act like hormones and therefore cause all kinds of problems in the human body, from reproductive development problems to cancer. And DDT was one of these. And this was something that Rachel Carson had actually speculated about in Silent Spring. She didn't have enough proof to tie it together. But in the 90s and 2000s, once we had this part of the puzzle answered, scientists started looking at DDT again and saw, oh, in particular, people who were exposed to it when they were young, they do have a higher risk of cancer, among other health problems.
There is also the tensions around lactation and nursing and passing, you know, DDT from the nursing mother into their baby. What was happening there?
Another really good question. So this is something too that scientists had documented from the beginning. Scientists at the FDA during World War II were feeding DDT to all kinds of animals in the lab. And one thing they noticed early on was when they gave DDT to the first dog they gave it to, then had pups, and they noted that DDT was in her milk, and then it was passed on to her pups, and then her pups were consuming the DDT. And scientists continued to study this and eventually also documented that DDT was in breast milk. Mm. And this was a big part of what helped turn the local and federal regulators against DDT in the late 1960s and 1970s. You know, one of the big public worries was, is DDT causing cancer? And we had only really preliminary evidence, and it wasn't very strong, but it was very clear that DDT was in women's breast milk. And one environmental organization in the early 1970, 1971 ran a big page in the New York Times and said, hey, DDT is in breast milk at levels that the World Health Organization says is unsafe. Is this a chemical you want to be feeding to your babies? And you can imagine the public reaction to that.
Huge outcry. Yes.
Huge, huge. Yeah, yeah. And this prompted scientists, in part, this is one of the things that prompted scientists to start looking at, well, if DDT is in breast milk, what is it doing to the breast? What is it doing to breast health? And sure enough, in the early 1990s, the first few studies came out showing what seemed to be an association between DDT and breast cancer. Now we have decades worth of studies that have looked at this connection. And they actually show conflicting evidence, although it seems quite clear that the studies that looked at women who were exposed to DDT in their developmental years, mm-hmm. they are at a much higher risk of breast cancer due to that exposure. And it's linked to other forms of cancer as well, but breast cancer had a real effect on the public imagination.
But people who are pushing back on that science are saying, hey, you know, you reach a level in your body and you just hit an equilibrium. There really isn't, you know, once the buildup happens, it kind of stops. When was mm-hmm. that debunked?
So that thinking was around for a really long time, and that was an idea promoted by government chemists and toxicologists who insisted back in the 40s and 50s that DDT was safe. And there was one scientist in particular who worked for the Centers for Disease Control, and he had been testifying, you know, before Congress and all kinds of court cases that DDT was safe because after a while you just didn't store any more in your body, you excreted it. In the late 1970s, through some routine testing, fish in the Tennessee River in Alabama were found that had extraordinarily high levels of DDT. And this came to the attention of a mayor of one small, almost entirely black town mm-hmm. outside of Huntsville, Alabama, who said, hold on, if those fish have DDT, then the people in my town must have DDT in their bodies because the town was right on the river. People routinely fished and ate the fish from that river as part of their weekly meals. So he raised the alarm, and he was the mayor of this town, Triana, Alabama. He also happened to work for the federal government. And he was well-connected, knew how things worked. And within a week, he had scientists from the CDC, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and other government agencies down in his town investigating the problem. And this is the very tail end of the 1970s. DDT was already banned, and he was just finding it in his people. And these scientists came down, and one team from the CDC gathered samples from people's bodies and took them back to the lab and said, whoa, some of them have the highest levels of DDT ever detected. Mm. They went back and got more samples, and looking at hundreds of samples from the town, they said, and wait a second, the older they are, the higher their levels. It's not true that you eliminate it after a certain point. This whole idea has been false. And so this CDC epidemiologist who did these studies actually carried out a number of studies. And in part, this became the basis for a massive settlement that the town got from the DDT manufacturer that had operated upstream on an army base
and had just let waste from that plant find its way into the river where it accumulated in fish and found its way into people's bodies.
UC Berkeley Professor Elena Conis on the legacy of DDT, the toxic chemicals, environmental peril. Still time to reflect on DDT, ask questions. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Elena Conis here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A recent headline in the LA Times, so pertinent to our discussion this hour. Scientists found new and mysterious DDT chemicals accumulating in California condors, and they identified more than 40 DDT-related compounds, along with a number of unknown ones. Still time to talk about DDT, 800-642-1234. The book is called How to Sell a Poison. Author Elena Conis stays with us for about 9 more minutes. So, Elena, when I saw that news article, I said, oh, my goodness, this is one of the reasons she wrote the book. And I was wondering if you could address, just the impact on wildlife and also I was horrified by these ocean dumps of DDT where these companies were just offloading all of this DDT in the ocean.
It's horrifying to us today, I know. And yet you don't have to go back very far in time to find moments when it was perfectly legal to do so. They got permits to dump those chemicals in the ocean. but going back to that headline from the LA Times earlier this week, yeah, this is the other part of the DDT story that connects to the events in Wisconsin. Wisconsin was one of the first states to get a ban on DDT in the late 1960s. And part of how they did so was by the Department of Natural Resources held hearings. And the hearings were organized in order to determine whether DDT was polluting waters. And the group that was in charge of bringing in witnesses to show that it was in fact a pollutant was working with, well, there was the Conservation Natural Resources Association in Wisconsin. They were working with a group in New York called calling themselves the Environmental Defense Fund. They were brand new at the time. And they brought in loads of scientists, mainly ornithologists and other wildlife biologists, who had noticed that not only was DDT building up or killing insects, but because it was killing insects, it was having an effect on birds. Mm. Birds would eat insects, birds would eat, worms and whatnot, and sometimes get small enough doses of DDT that they wouldn't die, but they would be found tremoring. And sometimes they were getting large enough doses, especially from spraying, where they would be flat out killed. They also knew of some studies that had shown that when DDT was sprayed on a lake, for instance, the DDT stayed for a really long time. And even if the spraying didn't kill any birds outright at the beginning, over time, birds that fed on fish in that lake would end up dying off because they were getting constant doses from the fish, because DDT, again, stuck around in fat. It accumulated both in bodies and also up the food chain. Mm. And so these organizations of people brought in scientists to testify as much in these hearings in Wisconsin in 1968. And this just closed the case for the hearings examiner.
I just want to pause here and bring in Rory in Chippewa Falls, who wants to dig more deeply into this. Rory, hi, go ahead.
Hi. There's actually a book that was written contemporaneously about 1970 about the banning of DDT, and I was going to bring that up. But your guest actually did a much better description of getting rid of it than I did.
Do you remember, Rory, those hearings in Wisconsin?
No, I was a college out in Connecticut.
Okay.
I grew up in Rice Lake, Wisconsin. I live in Chippewa Falls, and I heard about the books. I read it about maybe 8 years ago.
I wonder, Elena, what did the Wisconsin hearings do in terms of the rest of the country and out in D.C.?
Well, they really scared the chemical industry. And the chemical industry redoubled its efforts to come to DDT's defense. They also emboldened the environmental groups, including the Environmental Defense Fund, the Sierra Club, the Audubon Society, and others who said, let's try to get this banned nationally. And I should point out, to kind of bring us back to those, you know, the DDT that's being found in condors and also in the waters off the California coast right now, you know, they knew that DDT was harming birds, and they were just beginning to show how far that harm had gone. There were top of the food chain birds, predators like peregrine falcons and bald eagles, whose numbers had been declining, and scientists were showing that it could be tied back to DDT and related compounds. And by that, I mean isomers, different kind of chemical forms of the product, and also breakdown products of DDT as it's broken down in the environment. They were showing that these top of the food chain birds were being affected by DDT so long after it had been sprayed. And this goes back to its powers as an endocrine disruptor. Mm-hmm. It was affecting the function of estrogen in birds. And estrogen plays a key role in birds' ability to lay strong eggs. And without estrogen functioning properly, birds were laying thin eggs, and thin eggs, thin shelled eggs, break. They're not viable. Their reproductive rate just started to plummet. And so we saw the loss of so many of these kinds of birds. DDT also just builds up over time. And that's why, you know, combine that with the ocean dumping that was routine for decades, that's why we still see DDT in the ocean and the places where it was dumped. This has been recently documented off the California coast, but DDT was manufactured in so many places where we haven't even begun to look at its environmental accumulation. We're pretty good at cleaning up on land, but the oceans, we haven't even started.
We only have a minute left, but I'm wondering, is the fight over DDT going to continue?
You know, it'll probably continue, although at this point, we're all pretty convinced that this is a toxic chemical whose costs outweigh its benefits. What is continuing, though, is this larger story that DDT is connected to. You know, we've been talking over the hour about small farmers, farm workers, Blacks, women, and others who raised alarms about DDT that were often dismissed by health officials in many cases. And in some cases just were heard but not acted upon. Mm-hmm. And for me, this is what's still continuing. We still see this pattern where people who are not directly involved in science struggle to trust it when they don't feel like their interests are being taken into account, and when they don't feel like their worries and concerns are being taken seriously, and when they don't feel like they're being told the truth. You know, it's hard to look back at this history sometimes and see scientists saying one thing to the public and another thing to each other. And we hope that's not happening today, for sure.
Elena, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on, Kate. It's been a pleasure.
Elena Conis, professor of history and journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, focus on the history of medicine, environmental health, author of the new book, How to Sell a Poison: Rise, Fall, and Toxic Return of DDT. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.